We're recording now. So, hey, folks, thanks for tuning in to the BAMF podcast, formerly the Vigilance Press podcast. This is Mike Lafferty and your usual host. And today I'm talking with Charles Phipps. Hey, Charles, how you doing?
Hey, I'm doing fine there. How about yourself?
All right, great to have you. And Charles, as many of you probably know, is author of Halt Evildoer, A Setting for Mutants and Masterminds, and has been very active on the forums in fleshing out that particular setting over the last year or so. And it's available on RPG Now, I believe, in we had two different versions, didn't we, Charles?
Yes, indeed. We did two ebook versions and one physical copy.
Okay. And those are also available on RPG Now, or what do you have for sale on RPG Now? Let's talk about that.
Yes, well, we have the Halt Evildoer 2nd Edition available on RPG Now, which I really recommend everyone pick up. And we also have the physical version of that available at Amazon.com.
Okay, yeah, so if you like the Dead Tree books, you can get that too. And, full disclosure, I worked a little bit on this one. It's a gorgeous book, lots of great art. And, it's a really fun setting. I mean, as evidenced by people are so taken with it, there's still very active setting threads on the Atomic Think Tank forum developing this. But, hey, before we forget and before we get too far, you mentioned before we get started you've got some other projects you're working on you wanted to kind of promote at the top of the podcast. So can you tell us what you're doing these days?
Oh, yes. Well, I'm currently developing a pair of superhero books, which I hope to actually branch out into a full superhero novel setting there. I'm currently feeling around for a publisher, but if necessary, this is the day where everyone is publishing online. And guess what? If no longer having the same stigma and the quality is just as good as the professionally done stuff, that gets overlooked by 18 editors.
Okay. Go ahead. No, please, after you.
Oh, well, it's called Merciless, the World's Most Wanted. Well, this is the name of the first book, and the second book is How I Became a Supervillain, which is a prequel.
Okay, cool. And those are both done? They're both in development?
The first one is done. The second one is about halfway done, though I already have everything outlined.
Oh, cool. Have you considered doing Kickstarter? So that's kind of the new hotness these days.
Could you repeat that last bit?
Have you thought about doing Kickstarter? Because that's what all the kids are doing these days.
Oh, well, I'm exploring all options there. Everything has its ups and downs in the current economy there. Wonderful books that get written and have incredible plots, incredible production values, and so on, don't anyone buy them? And the same for the crappy qualities, I'm afraid, if I may use that word.
Yeah, no, that's cool. That's cool. Okay. So any time frame on when you'll be, when the people should be looking for that?
I'm hoping it'll be released by March.
Okay, cool. So that's, that's coming up fast, actually, because right now we're in mid-November, so... Well, early November, so cool. All right, we'll keep the eyes out for that. Maybe we can have you back when one of those comes out. Now, talk about Halt Evildoer. Obviously, a very popular setting. Can we talk a little bit, kind of give us the elevator pitch, the elevator pitch for the world kind of thing? Who are the major players and whatnot?
Yeah, well, I always liked Mutant's Mastermind system there because it was a great, great system. But I wasn't really terribly enamored of the whole Freedom universe, which is a wonderfully designed universe, but went very, 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 very Silver Age, while I prefer something a little bit more Marvel-esque, modern. There is something to be said for all the other settings that were out there from third parties, but strangely, I've noticed that a lot of them tend to veer toward the Iron Age above everything else.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
I wanted to do something a little different, which was still create something recognizably heroic, but settle in a little bit more to something that people might be reading today. So I settled down, got all my ideas together, contacted some friends who were devoted players and fans of comic books. Eventually I contacted you as well, and eventually Halt Evildoer came.
Yep. Now, I want to kind of try to flesh out for the listeners the setting, but it's, it's such far-ranging and, wide setting. It's hard to know where to start. Why don't we start with the cover of the book? It's kind of seems like a good place. On the front, we've got kind of a hooded villain wearing sort of a snake circlet, and, it's one of these classic kind of menace covers from the Bronze Age. in his hands, you've got a couple guys who sort of resemble maybe a Batman and Superman type. Can we talk about who we have on the cover and who those guys are?
Yeah, that's General Venom, who is sort of the Cobra Commander meets Baron Zemo figure of the set, and he's my favorite villain out of all of them together. He's this tragically misguided guy who thinks, well, the world is completely screwed up, so obviously I have to be the one to rescue it from its complete and utter chaos. The irony of being he was actually a former superhero during the 1970s who didn't see the light the same way Captain America did when he went through his nomad phase.
Yeah, he was kind of a Captain America analog originally, right?
Yeah. He was the halt evildoer version of Captain America during the 1960s, doing all the various Vietnam-era heroics and so on there, originally being very anti-communist, but keeping with the Captain America tradition, deeply disenchanted with the conservatism that had taken over everything. In the end, he decided that democracy had not so much failed as it had been betrayed by its leaders, and decided that he needed to take over the United States and set things right. It's always been a question in the background that I've written up whether or not he's honestly driven crazy by some external source or if he's just genuinely that nuts.
Okay, and who are the two heroes you're starting there on the cover?
That would be Blackwing and Divinos, who, as you mentioned, are the Batman and Superman analogs there. I went with the whole legacy theory of Batman with Blackwing and decided to just go with what if Bruce Wayne retired and what if a golden age Batman had existed and what if eventually Robin had taken over and so on. I think it's actually something that Grant Morrison is currently experimenting with in his comic run.
Yeah, some of that happened. Robin was Batman Dick Grayson was Batman for a few months there in the DCU.
When, yeah, now he's back seeing Nightwing, which, you know, everyone knew was coming, but I'm kind of sad about it.
Well, you always knew Steve Rogers was going to be Captain America again. He wasn't really dead, but, you know.
Yeah.
So, okay, cool. And Divinos, tell us a little bit about him.
Yeah, well, Freedom City had the Centurion, who was this really great character. He was very much the kind of Clark Kent is the real face of Superman kind of character.
Mm-hmm.
A guy born and raised in the city, but still salt of the earth, sort of like if Steve Rogers had become Superman.
Mm-hmm.
But I felt that a lot of the appeal of Superman is the Kal-El aspect, basically the guy who is from an alien planet and dealing with it. So I sort of tried to create a Martian Manhunter Superman analog in Divinos. This guy comes from the dying civilization. He came as a full adult. And he's just trying to help humanity reach the level of maturity he saw in his own civilization.
Okay, now he's got some other connections within a bunch of connections within HEAD, because one of the things you do is you've got a lot of branching relationships. I'm going to say there's Battlezar, who's sort of the Red Sun analog, who, you know, he's someone from his home world to land in the Soviet Union. And then, tell us about the others.
Yeah, well, the fun thing about Superman I always liked, which the comics had done decades without, was that Superman really wasn't the last son of Krypton. There were the Phantom Zone villains. There's obviously his cousin Kara. They had Power Girl and, of course, General Zod. Well, it occurred to me that you could create a General Zod analog and so on, but why not, you know, get a little interesting with the motivations there? So I had another survivor of the Mithran, who are just the Kryptonian analogs, land in Soviet Russia and become pretty much a hero like the General Venom, just a guy very devoted to the party and very devoted to his country that drastically went off in his own direction. He's now sort of the big rival for the Divinos in the world, trying to bring back the Soviet-era communism and all that.
Okay, and he runs an organization called the Red Spider, I believe, sort of a kind of like a Cobra / Hydra sort of thing.
Yeah, it's basically just a typical Soviet-era collection of villains there. But like the House of Serpents, which is my Cobra analog, they have their own ideology, and, you know, there's a point there. It's just if players want to smash them in the face because they're bad guys, they can.
Okay, all right. You know, obviously it's a big world. You're the guy, you're the author behind it. Who are some of your favorite characters besides the three we just touched on?
Well, yeah, Blackwing and General Venom really are my two favorite characters there. But it's interesting enough, I tried to write the whole thing like I was writing a comic book. In plenty of source books and so on there, they write up individual characters, and they don't really talk about how all of these people interact in the greater whole. And I think that really hurts the whole comic book feel that people come to books for. I think the whole DC and Marvel analogs are the places people really want to come to because you can immerse yourself in the history there. So I can't really just go point out, like, to Lucien Drake, who is the demon writer. He's kind of like the ghost writer analog, and say, well, he's a great character, and I absolutely love him, but without pointing out that he's a great character because he has all these interactions with everyone else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, kind of, there's a lot of context you kind of build into it, which sort of enriches the world. Well, let's talk about one of my favorites, if we're casting about, Ymir's Radioactive Viking. I thought he was a lot of fun, and got a great of art done by DMAC, Darren Calvert, on page 142 of All the Evil Doer. And that was a fun...
Well, you really pointed out a lot of the places I had weaknesses in the first volume there, because I tried to rush that one out there, but it managed to come off surprisingly well despite that. Still, there were plenty of holes in characters and places I hadn't really enriched on. And one of the cool things that you helped inspire was the idea I was kind of lacking in mythological Thor analog, and Ymir sort of basically bore straight out of my imagination as Brian Blessed with a hammer.
Nice. Yeah, it's great art, and I kind of like your take on the Norse mythos and his background. Sort of recast Loki as more of a sympathetic character.
Well, the interesting thing about Norse mythology is that what we think of as Norse mythology is actually a fairly recent phenomenon. Christianity is a religion about 2,000 years old, and by the time it finally came to us, the legends written down, they've been heavily influenced, casting Loki as basically Satan. And it occurred to me it might be fun to just cast the characters by their own cultural values. The Norse are a very violent warrior people in the Asgardians, while Loki is a trickster, but he's also actively trying to avoid his destiny as the destroyer of the world. So, amusingly, to modern heroes, he's likely to be an ally as an enemy, and Ymir is on the side of the giants because, well, they don't want to die any more than anyone else. Well, the Asgardians are more, okay, Ragnarok is going to come, so let's just get it over with.
Mm-hmm. And Ymir, he's a scientist, Canadian scientist, we should point out, doing some experiments up with some kind of atomic device, and he opens a rift in reality. Loki is freed from whatever imprisonment he was in, and Loki kind of becomes his sort of his mentor in a way. And obviously in the same experiment, what was this guy's name? Miles Westlake was imbued with various powers, and Loki had the dwarves Niflheim, was it? Forging that hammer?
It just kind of came out of that Neil Gaiman-ist place of just wrapping all these various elements together and seeing what happens there. One person described Miles Westlake, the Ymir character, as what would happen if Bruce Banner found the Hammer of Thor.
Nice. You know, they're making Bruce Banner into kind of a mad scientist character the last couple issues. Actually, the last issue of Hulk that I read.
Mm-hmm.
But,
Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, it was like we talked about earlier, you know, eventually he'll go back to being part of the Hulk, but right now they're separate and the Hulk is living with the mole people.
Yeah, well, comics have to continually do new things left and right, even if they're going to take characters back to their original roots. I mean, no one expected the electric blue Superman to last, but it's still pages, I guess.
Yeah. Well, hey, a couple of the characters we've got here that were accidentally too far from Ymir, I was scrolling through the PDF. I think Ultimatum on, say, page 137 and 138, he's kind of he's Captain Marvel, isn't he?
Mm-hmm. Well, I wanted to try and examine what would happen if you did give your typical 8-year-old boy the powers of Superman. And it's probably ended up better than it could have with. He made a royal mess of things and really destroyed his reputation as a hero. Still, he managed to save a bunch of lives and eventually some nice older hero straightened him out. So Ultimatum is kind of on a quirky redemption quest for things he had no real control over.
Now, he's in the Tomorrow Society these days, right? Which is kind of the X-Men?
Yeah, well, the Tomorrow Society is something I wanted to do without seeming too much of a ripoff of the X-Men. You needed, obviously, some place where all these kids who have superpowers and people who have developed them could go to train, but you didn't just want to make it a place where only mutants went, and if they did, would... I've always thought it was strange that Charles Xavier, who has this big dream of peace between mutants and humans, surrounds mutants just with each other, so they, you know, are completely closed off from the rest of the world. The Claremont Academy, which was done in the Freedomverse, was a really good idea and set in direction, but I decided I might go my own by creating more or less superhero Hogwarts.
Nice.
Yeah. The Tomorrow Society is a bunch of oddballs who are have various powers and so on and try and do the world thing, but they're less of a team than they are the school's personal defense force.
Okay. Now, could we talk about some of the other members of the Tomorrow Society?
Yeah, well, there's Ymir, who is basically a hero big enough that if he wanted to, he could gladly join the Patriots, which are the big superhero of the team, but decided instead to help out the little guys who he thinks are oppressed and hunted by the government and so on there.
Mm-hmm.
They, you know, lend his a reputation to try and show these are okay people. There's Lucien Drake, who, of course, is a half-demon and obviously isn't going to win many people over to begin with. Ultimatum, who everyone thinks is this rampaging Hulk-like monster, who is really just this nice Billy Batson-style guy. Plus, Serena Mass, who is the sister of the Red King. She's kind of what would happen if the Scarlet Witch ended up being the head of the Xavier Academy.
And her code name is Madame Tomorrow. And hey, just a quick divergence, so just to give context, can you tell us a little bit about the Red King? Cassius Mass?
Oh, yeah.
He's a
Go ahead.
Not you.
Yeah, but the Red King was my attempt to figure out what exactly a mutant supremacist would be without being a direct ripoff of Magneto. I figured it was cool to give some guy who actually thought, you know, hey, we are the superior beings and we are capable of changing the world however we want, so let's just actually go out and be superior. The humor value coming from the fact he's probably like the weakest superhuman in the entirety of the world, possessing powers to affect emotions, as is the whole thing, but he's a super genius.
Oh, you know, cool. And now he's got his own country, pretty much, doesn't he?
Yeah, I decided to go with the whole new country sort of thing in the setting because, hey, DC has done some great stuff with it, so has Marvel. Genesis Island is the place where he's created to be his new utopia, filled with all this stolen alien and superhuman technology. And it's so powerful that every other nation in the world has to deal with it on a semi-equal level. But he just uses it for all the various wonderful terrorist plots that we know.
Mm-hmm. Now, they recently had a... one of the developments between first edition and second edition Help Evil Doer was there was a revolution on Genesis Island, wasn't there?
Yeah. I had the whole idea that the Red King was kind of stale, and it would be good to do a progressing timeline as actual time passes. When and if I get around to Halt Evil Doer 3, it'll be 2-3 years down the line. I decided to do some of the old White Wolf shakeups by getting rid of the elements I didn't like and streamlining some things and progressing the characters a bit. In Genesis Island, it still is the same mutant-controlled dictatorship it is, but the humans decided that, you know, hell, we were strong enough to have our own rights respected, and they had a big blowout. The mutants kind of won, but things are slightly better, and it makes the situation more ambiguous because the Red King isn't just, like, holding them slaves or anything.
So how did it change the status quo on Genesis Island, or did it?
Oh, did you say how I changed the world?
I know, how did that revolution change the status quo on Genesis Island?
Oh, well, the humans have a much stronger place, and Cassius Mass' position is much weakened. If the heroes of the, by which I mean the PCs, came to the world of, sorry, the island of Genesis, they could pretty much overthrow the government if they really wanted to, maybe set themselves up as the new leadership or install a democracy, you know, do superhero things that they were. Because control was no longer nearly as absolute as it used to be.
Okay, okay. Wait, we kind of took off from some other side to talk about Cassius Mass. I think the last person we mentioned was Madame Tamara, who's Cassius Mass's sister, running a sort of... anybody else you want to talk about on the Tamara Society?
Oh, well, there's my favorite character, who is Valkyrie. She's Ultimatum's sister, and she's just this adorable character. I use her in my home campaigns a lot, as just the generic young teenage girl sidekick.
And,
she has the powers of the Valkyrie, basically, and it's hilarious the way that she's way too smart for her own good, and I think most game groups would just absolutely love her.
Okay, and she's on page 139, and there's a I don't recognize this particular artist. I did the piece on 140. I'm trying to remember the guy's name.
Yeah, I'm sorry. It's just totally escaping me right now. She, they were definitely a good choice, though, because I'm particularly fond of that picture.
Let's see. We had Fortman, Fur Trapper Studios, Dave Anderson, Olivier, Darren Bulmer, Darren Calvert, John Gibbons doing the art. Okay, well, yeah, it's great art. It's one of those guys, maybe Dave Anderson, seems likely, but because he's the layout, too.
Yeah, I think it was David Anderson, definitely.
Yeah. Again, there's a big DA on the corner of the picture, so that seems likely. So, yeah, and nice layout look on this book, too. So, yeah, well, okay, so we touched on Cassius Mass, touched on the Tomorrow Society, talked about a couple of the big kind of headlining heroes. You know, some people would say a setting is defined, you know, maybe more by its villains than by its heroes, because that's who the players are going to interact with more. Who are some of your favorite villains aside from General Venom in Helldivaldor?
Oh, that's a good choice. One of the new characters I created was just absolutely vile and outright. You know, I wanted to do something with the typical Nazi holdover villain that was new. I just decided to make him a combination of the Joker and the Red Skull. Just pure undistilled evil. Sorry, pure distilled evil.
And madness. He's got plenty of crazy.
Oh, yeah. I also like Horcus, who is the ultimate bad of the setting, so to speak, there.
Yeah, he's kind of the dark side, isn't he?
Yeah, well, partially Thanos, too. The whole thing about Freedom versus one of the biggest bads of them all is Omega, who is a guy who literally destroys universes. I love the Freedom Verse, don't get me wrong, but Omega is not exactly the kind of character you can introduce lightly, nor is the kind of guy you can have a conversation with.
Indeed.
He's out to kill everything. Yeah.
Sort of like,
I figured it would be more fun to get in some of Darkseid's personality, which is that he's this educated erudite embodiment of tyranny.
Nice.
Yeah.
And I should point out. Oh, go ahead.
Yeah. Orcus was this basic demon prince kind of guy who's just as often screwing with the hero's lives personally because he wants their despair as he is trying to conquer the entire Earth.
And I should point out, we've got some really nice art by Mancer Bear, Darren Bulmer, for Orcus.
Mm-hmm.
And John Gibbons just did an incredible picture of Kent Wright for us. He's holding a glass, something green and terrible, and he's got a zombie Doberman on the leash there.
Oh, yeah.
That's what I like about John, is there's always those little touches like a zombie Doberman kind of solves things.
Oh yes. That was just wonderful work right there. Kent Wright was a character that whenever he shows up, he knows bad stuff is going to happen.
And Dracula is very active in the world of Halt Evildoer, and Dave Anderson did a really nice picture of him for us. That kind of what's that one video game you're really into?
I always thought that Dracula was kind of underrepresented in these games. Everyone pretty much treated him like he was just going to step off the boat and be staked.
Yeah.
It seemed a pretty poor way to treat one of the world's first supervillains. So I just made him the head of a big vampire conspiracy in the world. So player characters who actually want to take down the king of all vampires actually have to go through a horde of vampires first.
Castlevania. That's what it looks like here. But yeah, he's the head of Vampire Nation. They're centered in it's sort of his own little, you know, similar to Hydra or AIM. It's kind of his own little undead army, and they're you know, a powerful political force who, you know, interact with the other factions, and it's pretty cool the way that's worked out.
Oh yeah, I enjoyed throwing like half a dozen Hydras in my game setting there. It's not just one big overarching super villainous organization, the House of Serpents, Phantom. I like Death Mask, which is a character we haven't mentioned, as he's like one of my favorite villains overall. He's just this Dr. Doom meets Lex Luthor kind of character, ruler of his own country, descendant of Professor Moriarty, just the mastermind behind it all. And one of the things I got in the forums that I really didn't get into the books is he's also probably the nastiest person in the entire series. Maybe not to the in the same way as Count Reich, who is just pure evil, but there is nothing redeemable about him.
So he's sort of Lex Luthor meets Dr. Doom meets Simon Cowell, is what you're saying.
Oh, yes. Simon would say, man, aren't you being a little harsh?
Now whenever I look at Death Mask, I'm just going to hear Simon Cowell's voice, and it actually works pretty well, so, huh. Okay, well, cool. Those are some of the headlining villains. Now there's a couple of the heroes we haven't talked about. We had Art Four in the back. Actually, you know what? I think one of your more interesting villains we haven't touched on is the Iron Khan. Let's talk about him a little bit.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the Iron Khan, I always had an affection for Ra's al Ghul and the Mandarin from Iron Man.
Mm-hmm.
They're, you know, but one of the things that was always rather troubling during the early half of the 20th century, right up until the 1970s, was the treatment of Chinese villains was decidedly less than PC.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I decided to create a character who took that kind of history behind it, but went around it. He's a Mongolian conqueror straight out from the era of Genghis Khan, who just happens to be a sorcerer. The whole Chinese Yellow Peril element doesn't really enter into it because he's mostly opposed by Chinese superheroes. It's just he's recently expanded out into the West.
Okay, makes him a little less typecast. And he leads an organization as well, right?
Yes, he leads the Black Hand, which is basically the collection of every mystical secret society of evil you're ever going to find.
So that's your collection of evil sorcerers. Yeah. All right, cool.
Yeah. Someone said basically he's just kind of Lopan who can actually walk, and, well, why not?
All right. Let's see. We talked about that guy, touched on Balazar. Who are your favorite heroes we haven't talked about yet? Well, I mean, we obviously, Divinus and Blackwing were your two favorites, but the book's just chock full of them. There's got to be some others you come to mind.
Oh, yeah. I like Ashley Morgan, who's a character that doesn't really get much attention either on the forums or in the books.
Okay, and Ashley Morgan, she is the... Oh, tell us about her.
Yeah, she's basically this true-blooded, blue, American patriot kind of super spy who thought she was working for the government, sort of like Alias, but it turns out she was working for one of the terrorist organizations.
Mm-hmm.
So she became the Black Widow analog, trying to atone for all the various bad deeds she's done on General Venom's behalf. Only recently, just to see how it would react, she got turned into a vampire.
Yeah, just a couple of years ago. And we had, I want to say John Gibbons did some art for her, too. That's the one where she's looking like Black Widow there in a graveyard on top of a tombstone with a couple of 45s in either hand.
Yeah, that was the Mila Jovovich pose, I called it.
Yeah, it looks very underworld. And, boy, what page is she on in here? Well, I can search for her. But, yeah, she's in there. It's some great art by John Gibbons. It's worth checking out. And, you know, one guy I liked, and I guess he's kind of part of the Psychotic Seven, who we should be mentioning anyway, Red Leopard. And Dave did some great art. Looks a lot like Catman for this. And let's use him as a way to get you, you know, kind of talk about him and then touch on the rest of the Psychotic Seven, who were sort of one of the defining villain groups in the setting.
Oh, yeah. Oh, the fun thing about the 90s was it led to a lot of interesting stories when people finally did realize maybe we'd gone a little too far into the grim and gritty.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. 90s were filled with Rob Liefeld's anti-heroes and so on. And, you know, as much as Rob takes some flack, he was not nearly responsible for comics getting so ultraviolet and dark as people give him credit for. But the seminal work I always liked was Kingdom Come, which was fundamentally about 90s anti-heroes versus the classic.
Yep.
Yeah, so the Psychotic Seven were basically me trying to see basically what would happen if that happened in an actual setting, but take the next step there. A bunch of, which is the interesting part, heroes who really were had the best of intentions decide to do the whole authority thing and say, enough is enough, we're taking the world and fixing everything. And seeing how other heroes join them and other heroes oppose them. And roughly around 2000, they had a big old blowout, and half of the superheroes in the world either got outlawed or sent into hiding, while the others became the basis for modern-day superheroes. The Psychotic Seven are those who decided, we're not done yet, and pretty much just travel around the planet continuing their campaign of terror against people they do to be evil. The thing is, you know, now that they're hated by everyone else in the world, they just get more and more brutal. Well, the cool thing is there, a lot of characters I think actually have a potential for redemption, but while others are just pure evil, and it will be ultimately how the PCs react to the Psychotic Seven, that how the group eventually falls down, whether they try and become good guys again or fully go over to evil.
Okay. Well, who are some of maybe the standout characters in the Psychotic Seven we could talk about to kind of give some of the flavor of that group?
Yeah, one of my favorite characters from that group is Hecate, and I really wish I had managed to get a good picture of her, but I could never get a look that I really, really liked. Hecate was one of the interesting stories that I always felt was fridging was Donna Troy's family getting killed.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was just, I don't know what it is about comics, but they do hate families, don't they?
So much, yes.
Yes, but I swear, as soon as a superhero or superheroine has a child, that you can count that person's life on one hand. I decided that, well, there's a character who went around about doing this whole same thing and had their family destroyed and decided, you know, I'm not going to go back to being the character I was by a comic book. This one, I'm going to go find the person responsible and kill them. So basically had this wonderful sidekick character with the ties to Greek mythology who decided she's going to go get revenge. And that she became the Psychotic Seven's most darkest, hardest member and most to believe someone has to take care of all the bad guys in the world.
Okay, she's kind of a Scarlet Witch character, we said?
Well, I think more if she's Donna Troy with Cersei's powers.
Okay, all right. And let's see, someone else.
The girl is the mage.
Gotcha. Now, what about, we got a pretty cool picture by Dave on page 187 of Jack Union, the third. Can you tell us a little bit about him?
Oh, yeah. Oh, Jack Union is just awesome. I love to talk about this character, but it's so hard because he's such a jackass.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Jack Union was pretty much my attempt to combine all the various anti-hero attitudes of the 90s into one singular character, and of course you have to make that character British.
And wearing a trench coat.
Yeah, so Jack Union just has gravity manipulation powers and really doesn't care about the whole superhuman conflicts between good and evil. He's just out there to kick some heads.
Mm-hmm.
And be so dismissive to everyone in the process.
And so he's kind of very much the 90s anti-hero standing in this book.
Oh, yeah. Jack, under no circumstances could be ever accused of being a hero, except sometimes, and I accept that sometimes the people he's killing are slightly worse than him.
Oh, cool.
Jane Union is a character I actually like more because she's kind of what would happen if you gave incredible magical powers to Drusilla from Buffy. She's completely off her gourd.
It is a frightening thought. Now, they're sisters? Sorry, brothers and sisters? Siblings, what I meant to say?
Yeah. Basically, Jack and Jane come from a long line of British heroes who are very, very good people for the most part. They just unfortunately got a bad hand and went greatly down into the anti-establishment route, right up to the other side.
Okay. Well, hey, if we can, if we touch on Red Leopard a little bit, because that's a character I found pretty interesting.
Red Leopard is just a great character. Him and Aquarius are both the typical comic book monarchs.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there are people that come from a different time when they're supposed to, when the big important thing is for you to be the best warrior your kingdom has and protect them against all invaders while being noble and absolute dictators. Yeah, he comes from the Red Leopard comes from the country of Nestoria, which is based on the mythical kingdom of Prester John, the Christian kingdom in the middle of Africa that's overflowing with milk and honey and all that.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of like Wakanda, it's super technologically advanced too.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I decided to play with that. So what would happen if this country exists in real life? Well, obviously everyone and their brother would want its resources and technology.
Mm-hmm.
So it pretty much went nonstop under attack from the 80s onwards, right up until the point he decided, you know, screw this. I'm just going to go take out what I think is the party responsible, and that was the United States, and eventually it was going to be Europe. And, well, that backfired tremendously because it left the entire world vilifying him.
And hence his membership in the Psychotic Seven.
Yeah, he was a great character because I needed someone who would be the actual leader of the group, and I figured that the Black Panther was already sort of Batman.
Yeah, he is. Okay, well, cool. So there is a ton. I always wonder if you guys ever think about. I mean, let me preface by saying there's a ton. I mean, literally a ton of background material you guys have developed on the forums in the settings forum on Atomic Think Tank. Boy, it's been you, Krynos, Great Crusader, Libra. Who else has been writing on that?
Everyone just has the potential to do add to the world and continue on with the various substantial net presence.
Yeah, it's
often considered opening up a personal wiki and building a nice website for everyone's ideas to be sorted and cataloged and all that other stuff, but really, we're just doing it for the fun of it, and I think everyone who wants the material can look it up anyway. I've often been asked if we're going to put any of that material in ebook form, and I considered it, but I wanted to make sure it would be as high quality as the original book.
Okay. Yeah, because there's really a wealth of material, not so much stat blocks, but just as far as background and characterization goes, it's really kind of a treasure chest there.
Well, the one issue with stats is the game systems are always changing, and people are always going to be using whatever systems they can. Well, background material is forever.
Yeah, this is true. Yeah, I've thought about doing some systemlet supplements every once in a while, just because, yeah, like you say, I mean, you love a system, and then 5 years later, it's going to be a new system, and then something else will be hot a couple years later, and it just seems like, you know, maybe if you want to have some longevity, yeah, maybe that's the way to go.
There's plenty of surprising things that happen there. For example, I never expected Champions Online to be will probably outlast the RPG system.
Well, yeah, I've been playing Heroes City of Heroes for 7 years now. I've had a subscription to that.
People say what's going to happen in the tabletop RPG design. I said, well, no, it's just changed form.
Yeah, this is true. And I had a roommate for a while, and we were both gamers. And, you know, for a while we talk about putting together, you know, a gaming group and put up some flyers at the local game store and getting some guys. And he's like, you know, we can just jump on our computers and play City of Heroes with all of our friends back in Tucson. And it's a lot less work. And you don't have to worry about that one creepy dude you don't know showing up at your house. And I'm like, yeah, that's...
Oh, yeah. I think everyone who's... I think though that one creepy dude has done more to damage the hobby than anyone.
Yeah, and legions of internet trolls is... Yeah, that one creepy guy, if we could get him out of the hobby, everything would be great, but... He won't leave. So, yeah, it's, you know, it's sad. I still do a fair number of tabletop gaming, often over Skype. But, yeah, I mean, I hate to say it. I mean, I've even done as much or more role-playing sometimes in City of Heroes or Champions Online than I've done around the table, just because it's not the same, obviously. But, you know, it's
I often do my RPGing on chat on online chats, actually.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know in the past, like, one of the big ways that you promoted the original edition I've had was type of post thread in the game room on Atomic Think Tank. Are you still running those or thinking about bringing them back? Or?
Well, it depends on how it would be doing there. Everyone in the world is right now struggling for time, given the current economy and so on.
Yeah.
But if I ever did see an opportunity, I would take it, because these things are just wonderful. I'm still playing my own home games of ATD2.
Oh, okay, that's cool. So, how often do you get together a game? A couple times a month? A couple times a week? How do you do it?
A couple of times a week.
Oh, okay, cool. You're hardcore then. All right.
We try there. It's only for a couple of hours usually, but it's enough. It keeps the ball rolling.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of shorter sessions myself. They're just easier to schedule, and you don't have to argue with your girlfriend as much. And, yeah, unless you game with your girlfriend or wife, it makes things a lot easier.
Oh, my wife is totally not. Is still surprised that people actually game there. It's like millions of people do this online.
Well, if you're counting World of Warcraft, then yeah, you've got 8 to 10 million right there, depending. So, yeah. Although, how many of those are Chinese gold farmers is up to debate, too.
There's the fun part about online RPGing is we're finally getting the winnowing period where people think they could just release something and people will play it forever. That's why so many online RPGs have failed or gone free-to-play, because they just can't sustain numbers with low quality.
Shoot, I think everything's free to play these days that I'm interested in, except for World of Warcraft. DCU went free to play this last week or so.
Well, DCU was, I think everyone expected a little bit more from it than they really got, given the pedigree of it. It's a great brawler, but it is just, at the end of the day, a brawler.
Yeah. Well, that's part of the problem, is that the development time to get things right and the amount of playtesting you have to do and the production cycle and the profit expectations, they all kind of conspire to get things out the door before they're really finished. And people just figure they're going to get things, you have people who subscribe to it so you can finish it, as you go, but there's an initial disappointment and a drop off in numbers, and yeah, you end up going free to play. Marvel is doing their own MMO, and apparently they're going to have it set up where you can play Marvel signature characters. And,
I don't know how that's going to be, but definitely I'm going to be looking forward to that. One thing I am looking forward to is the Star Wars Old Republic, which I think will set the tone whether or not a huge investment in an online RPG will pay off dividends or not.
Well, if anyone is a Star Wars fan and hasn't heard of this game, go to YouTube and look at the trailers for Star Wars Old Republic MMO. And, there's four or five trailers. They're like 3 to 5 minutes long. And honestly, watching those is a lot more fun than watching all three prequels put together for me.
I totally agree there. They managed to distill all the perfect, wonderful action there. And I've been keeping very close attention to it. And I think it really will be a way to help revive the Star Wars phenomenon for a lot of people who grew disenchanted.
You know who's into Star Wars these days that kind of surprises me? Kids.
Go ahead.
I know so many kids under the age of 6 who went out as clone troopers this Halloween.
Oh, well, that's something that I think the 30-year-old fans are still mystified there, because for God knows how many kids there, Star Wars is just alive and well. And they love the prequels, which, again, I can't imagine. I think that I finally feel the generation gap.
Yeah, well, a friend of mine, her son, he's not so much into the prequels, but he loves Star Wars Lego.
Oh, yeah. Well, there's that CGI cartoon, The Clone Wars.
Yeah.
That's actually not bad by any stretch of the imagination. I like them better than the prequels, which isn't saying much. But it's still entertaining, and I would have loved it as a kid.
Yeah, I like it. I preferred the when they're doing it animated, when it was the guy from Dexter's Library, Tartovsky.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, I like it better. But yeah, I got some of the CG stuff on DVD. Actually, it's not bad. I will give you that. So yeah, the kids are digging it. I think maybe the old guys like us are still nursing the grudge because Han's shot first, and who the hell is this Jar Jar Binks bastard? But the kids are digging it. It's multi-generational. But I'm looking forward to
George Lucas. Yeah, sorry. Go ahead.
No, it's just along the same lines. George Lucas has a lot to answer for.
Well, George, I think George is playing with us half the time there. He's worn a couple of T-shirts saying "Hatton Kane shot first" convention.
When he was here in Denver at Starfest, he gave a really interesting speech that someone asked him about problems with fans, and he's like, oh, I don't have problems with fans. You know, Star Trek fans, those guys get crazy. My fans understand that you have to live your life. They understand the story of Star Wars was you have to move out of your parents' house, the way Luke left his, you know, uncle and aunt's house and go out and experience the world. So I don't have those kind of crazy fans like Star Trek has. I read the paper next day. I'm like, yeah, George is messing with dudes, isn't he? But,
Yeah.
That Mr. Lucas, you know, I like better thinking of him as a mischievous imp than the way I usually think of him, which is kind of a soulless, dead-eyed, you know, money-grubbing, you know, creep. But
George thinks of himself as the big anti-establishment god. But I point out, I don't think you do that when you have almost $1 billion.
Yeah, when you actually have a physical-sized reproduction of the Death Star in your backyard in Montana, it's hard to say you're not the establishment. But yeah, such is life. Such is life. Okay, well, hey, we've been jawing for a while. Anything else you want to touch on regarding Halt Evildoer?
No, I'm grateful that you guys have, who are listening have been so interested, and I hope everyone will either, A, pick up a copy or just check out the thread on the Atomic Think Tank forums and drop by and see if anything appeals to them. If you want to use it for your own stuff, go ahead.
Yeah, and it's an easy thread to find. I mean, there's been more than one, but if you just go to atomicthinktank.com and look up Charles Phipps in you know, on user search, I think the majority of your posts these days are showing up in those setting threads.
Mm-hmm. Oh, well, also just speaking, all of the threads have their own. Oh, sorry, I dropped my one behind me. Basically, I'm listed down there on the front page usually, and there's plenty of in the settings form, and there's plenty of links back to my stuff.
All right, sounds good. Hey, Chuck. Charles, sorry. Really appreciate your time. Thanks a lot, sir.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
All right, take care.